Good evening, everybody. It's Wednesday night. It's 7 o'clock on the West Coast, and we are continuing our work with the book, The Hidden Work, by E.J. Gold. The purpose of this particular adventure that we're on is to uncover ways and means by which we can solidify some of the work that we're doing, each one together. And what happens during this particular period of time is that we bring together a number of individuals. And those individuals, I don't know how many are on tonight, but it's going to be, you know, like 10, 15, something like that, and then a couple of people here. That, let's just say, the intentionality of that focus is what is we're trying to amass, Ivan. And the reason to do it is that it begins to create what I call a checkpoint, an inner checkpoint, because we can say with a little beginnings of a little bit of confidence that this is the beginning of what it feels like to be in that essential self space and to begin to operate there. Okay? How are we doing over there? We're ready to rock and roll? Okay. So last week we spent the entire hour, Ivan, just discussing the work we've been doing on prayer absolute and the fact that the prayer absolute is the basis, in a sense, of this particular book and how it's introduced in 11, and then 12 we unpack it. And as you know, we were on it for many, many weeks. And so some individuals spoke about their practice with prayer absolute and how they did with it, what they did, and how it worked for them or didn't work for them as a tool.
I'm sorry, I missed that session. Maybe I can listen to it.
It was a very good session. Maybe I'll try to send it to you as a audio file.
Well, I didn't try. It's posted, I think.
It is posted, yeah.
I just don't know whether the whole thing is there.
Yeah. So now what we're doing is we're moving into chapter 13. We're going to get started on chapter 13. It's a different type of chapter from 11 and 12, but it's a very important chapter in our overall work. That chapter is called Thought for Food. And if you go onto the website, which is wingsofchaos.com, you'll notice that Vidir and Pathworld put up a very nice summary. And are they on tonight? Okay. So it's worth reading the summary and some of the other things that were said on the site when you get a chance. Nothing critical about that. What's critical is what we bring to the event this evening. Even though we are separated by thousands of miles, you know, Simon is telling us he's in Toronto, Canada. That's, I don't know, 2,800 miles away, something like that. And yet, we feel a tangible result of that coming together of individuals. All right? Any thoughts on that, Simon?
No writings here.
Okay.
Actually, I'd like to say something, David. This is, without going too far off the subject, briefly. I spent almost a week in New York because I went to this trade show, and what I noticed is that it's, you know, from time to time I come back to remembering that exercise about the eternal day.
Yeah.
You know, the getting out of the ordinary time space and into the more essential. And, you know, it was very noticeable to me that in the hubbub, like in the trade show itself, I felt mainly the lack of something. You know, I felt like I wasn't doing something that I would like to be doing. It's like I don't have much ability to invoke, you know, essential nature, let's say, when I'm in the midst of some trying to achieve a goal, or I'm directed at something, or I have a, what would you call it, an agenda or whatever. It's hard for me. But I noticed that there was a day, I spent the better part of the day going to the Whitney Museum and wandering around this neighborhood where I was staying in, on the east side of Manhattan, because my niece lives there. And I fell into that a little bit, that sensation of the dilated time and so on, because it sort of came to me just because I was removing myself from, let's say, from having business, you know, from having appointments, from having an agenda. You know, I when I felt like I didn't have a goal, or I was more open to whatever might happen, and just encountering people on the street and going to a museum and so on, I had stretches where I was feeling that more essential space. So it was interesting, because I didn't do anything to bring it on, basically.
Well,
it was occurring to me.
But it was an interesting phrase you used that I wanted to comment on, is that you said you noticed that something was missing.
Yeah, this is actually the strongest sensation I had this year doing the trade show, was that I felt out of place. You know, I felt like I had a stronger impression than I've had in the past of it being a very mechanical space.
Yeah.
Of it being like a very...
But yet there was something, a sense something was missing. If you flip that from a negative formulation, you were aware that you were aware of the essential self in a sense, or...
By absence.
That's right.
Yeah.
By absence, which means that there's some radar going on there that's kind of looking for it.
Mm-hmm.
And Pat World has said to me over the years, you know, she always complains, well, I always forget to do the exercise.
Yeah, right, me too.
But she's always remembering that she forgets all the time. And she... always forgets to do this, always forgets to do this or that, but nevertheless always shows up. I don't know if she's here, pretty sure she's here tonight. But, and so what's that?
Well, you have identified something, I think, significant there, David. It's, for me, it's significant that I, it's a big difference in my experience to know that I sense that I'm noticing this. It's like I'm noticing that I'm noticing. That, for instance, that at a trade show, everybody is very hypnotized. You know, they're deliriously hypnotized, because that's what the whole environment is made to do, is to make them deliriously
hypnotized.
You know, devoted to these commercial displays. And you know,
they're actively asleep.
I heard people... Now, I overheard a conversation that, you know, like a couple of these booksellers or somebody with these big bags of stuff, and as one says to another, oh yeah, I got it, look at all this swag I got here, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh man, you collected all this. It's just like being in a game and collecting the gold coins.
What we don't want
opening
to
opening up all those chests.
What we don't want to recognize is that for me to recognize for that individual, that was an end in itself.
Well, this is like
that,
you know,
person
what brings
was
to mind,
complete.
It is like being in a game space, because it's like EJ's talking about, the part of the sensation that I had is like, these people are kind of acting like avatars. Like, where are the players that are behind these avatars? So the idea, the fact is that just, I felt more present just in the sense that I was sort of sensing that I had a player somewhere around.
Right.
and here I was the avatar on this trade show floor.
The difference is that those individuals were totally identified with their avatar, their human biological machine. There was no distinction. There was nothing they were missing. They were fully engaged.
Yeah, it's hard for me to judge that, but that's what it felt like.
Well, it's hard for us, because we don't want to admit that either. We don't want to see, oh my God, that is really asleep. Go ahead, Simon.
Well, that's that's very apropos that you are saying, because I remember in the past reunion we were talking about what was our experience with the prayer absolute. And in a moment I said, you asked me, David, so what did you feel? I say, I felt like I was like in a theater, like in a play.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's the idea, that I was like a, you call it avatar, I call it characters.
The reason we use the word avatar is because EJ works extensively with the electronic media, and he works a lot with gaming, and presently he's working with a new adventure called Second Life. And in all of those games, you have a character that you as the operator are operating.
Mm-hmm.
You're operating the character, and you realize that you are working the avatar. Gradually you begin to see that. Well, gradually we begin to see that I'm working this avatar called David, and it's moving around. A lot of the times I may not see what it is doing. But years ago, I was actually up in Toronto, Canada. I was meeting with Jim Anthony.
Oh, yeah.
And he asked me to speak to his group. They had this group lunch. They have a big group up there. And what occurred to me was that I could, in certain limited ways, I could feel myself falling asleep, by which I meant at the time falling into sleep patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And when I would notice myself do that, it would wake me up
mm-hmm.
to some patterns. All right? And that was the talk I gave to that little group of his students there on 83 Girard Street in Toronto, Canada. So once you begin to get a sense, once you begin to get a sense of the fact that you are an essential self, and there begins to be work to do there, other things kick in from the machine that we don't want to face. So that's part of the work that we are here to do, is to have a realistic understanding of the balance of both the machine and the essential self, a realistic understanding. That means you don't eliminate either side. Make sense?
Yeah.
Makes sense. We're going to get into that a little bit more, maybe or maybe not tonight. But I do want to open the book to chapter 13, Ivan.
Okay.
And let's go ahead and actually begin our way through the chapter, because we have two mountains to climb after chapter 13.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how we're going to even do that. But let's start. And why don't you give us a get-go on chapter 13.
Thought for food. As we take food up into our personal cosmos, it awakens to our own extent of consciousness. What we eat becomes part of us and partakes of our own degree of consciousness.
And what we're going to see is that the concept of what we eat has meaning on different levels, but it also has a meaning, a very real meaning, just in a pragmatic level of food, physical food that the machine takes in. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this first paragraph because it's there's quite a bit to it. So let's open that one up. Okay. Here is a method of bringing the machine to life. Now, remember where we are in this book. We're on chapter 13. We've just been through a in-depth unwinding of prayer absolute. We're really strong, and now we've talked about prayer absolute, and now we've left it in a sense. Now we're about to take a breath in a certain way, okay? It's a different kind of breath. But look what the author tells us. He says, here is the method of bringing the machine to life. And then he goes, in connection with prayer absolute. That's an orientation. And we have to understand as we read, like Ivan, you weren't here, but I actually brought some reading from the Talmud last time.
Oh, I missed it.
You missed it. And I actually would have liked to have been here because it was just some very profound stuff. But in the same way, we have to be able to read this material. This is what's given to us. It's not going to be edited. It's not going to be changed. This is what's given to us. So the first sentence says, here's a method of waking up, right? Waking up and bringing the machine to life. But then in connection with Pure Absolute. And I think that the reader needs to keep that in mind, that it's in connection with that. So we're still in the realm of Pure Absolute. That's my point. Mm-hmm. All right? If we're not involved in Pure Absolute, then we're into something else. But right now, the author is telling us, hey, you're still in this, baby. You didn't leave it and suddenly go somewhere else. All right? Point of caution. The evocation of sacred mood and atmosphere begins with deep contemplation upon the subjective sensing and feeling experienced by man on the cross, which is to say, seeing through his eyes, feeling through his heart, sensing through his body. So, Simon, what do you think is meant by evocation of sacred mood?
Well, is to put in my case, I will take that as is my attitude. First, it begins with an attitude. In my attitude to relive, to make alive that prayer, and get myself in that mood, in that sacredness. It's a holy moment. It's a communion.
Yeah, communion. So you work with communion in that manner.
Right.
So this paragraph is doing is it's putting us in context here. The author is like saying, don't forget where you are. What is the chamber in which you are? What is the atmosphere in which we are in? Okay? That's what he's telling us. So let's take that in then. Evocation of sacred mood. And then what's the next phrase there? And he says, the atmosphere begins with deep contemplation. That's different than passing interest. Okay? That means, I was talking to Jana the other day about the idea of the clear light prayer, which comes out of the ABD. And if you recall this prayer, if you've worked with it all, it starts and it goes something like this. It says, now I am experiencing the clear light of objective reality and so on. But now the reader is placed in that position by the very saying of the words and the words. And what are the first sentences out of Genesis, Ivan?
In the beginning
was the Word. Okay, and so we're talking about the depth of the Word here. And so once again, we are here. We're in the atmosphere called deep contemplation about the subjective sensing and feeling experience by the man on the cross. And so there we're talking about the master of the universe, and the master of the universe frozen in this attitude of crucifixion, really. It is a crucifixion. And we've worked a lot with, many of us have over the years, with the New Testament. And if you look at the first three Gospels of the New Testament, the three Gospels all actually speak of the moment on the cross of Jesus being crucified very differently. We always think it's just one thing, says the same thing, it doesn't. It's three different things. So, man on the cross, right? What does that mean? That's a mystery we have yet to uncover. And then, of course, he says, eyes, feeling, sensing. Okay? So that's the kind of like the methodology in a certain way. So that's all. So this first paragraph just says, you know what? You guys have been taking a break here. I'm going to just put you back into context. So time to get back to work. and get busy again.
I'm just going to make a comment here from Piangelo. In regard to that, he says, organic food is transformed by us when we consume it, just as we are transformed when consumed by the Absolute.
And last time we had a bit of a saying from one of the rabbis, the Talmudic commentator, saying that let my will be his, be thy will, his will, so that he may use my will as his will. And what we're saying there is to surrender to the fact that we are a little button of the divine. This is not a New Age concept. I go on Facebook every once in a while. I don't know why I do. I go on there and I look through these things and everybody has this thing. Says, oh yeah, you're God. You're like God. Well, it's just a word. But what we're talking about is making it manifest. And you make it manifest. But if something happens, it is frightening when you do that. There's no free ride here, okay? All right? Then, when this is going well, we can turn our attention to contemplation of the process of growth and preparation of food. From the first moments of planting, hatching, or birth, tracing the journey from its source, all the way to marketing and preparation of the table, and then into our mouths, through the stomach, small intestine, then through the colon, and finally out the window, so to speak, to the sewers and back to the earth. So I just want to once again emphasize in our reading that we have to read carefully, because the context of now is you're saying you're in the context of prayer absolute and you're in the contemplation of man on the cross. That's right? Am I reading this about right? Am I getting this right, Dan? He thinks so too. And if that's the case, he says, that's where you start. Okay, now go. Let's go talk about planting your food. So these are the, not the master gardeners, but the holy gardeners. The holy gardeners that come through and they pierce the earth in a certain way, but they pierce it with a certain caring and compassion that arises from that very evocation that we're talking about, that Simon was of sacred mood and atmosphere. Many good foods require hours of preparation, yet may be consumed without much attention in only minutes. We should strive to eat the food slowly with the fullest possible concentration of attention upon the sensation of eating, and at the same time trying to sense and feel what the food subjectively senses and feels as we cut it into smaller parts. What do you think he means by that? That's so weird. What could he possibly mean? Anybody? What does he mean? And then trying to sense and feel what the food subjectively senses. Help me out here.
Could you reread the paragraph, David, please, again?
Yes, I'll reread it. So he starts the paragraph by saying, place your attention on the sensation of eating. At the same time, trying to sense and feel what the food subjectively senses and feels. As we cut it into smaller parts, spear it with a fork, pick it up with a spoon, raise it to our lips, and tear it, rip it up, dismember it, chew it, grind it, pulp it, liquidate it with our inexorable molars, swallow it, digest it, finally eject the remains from when the machine is taken what it can. What does it feel like?
Yeah. Well, definitely it's a full exercising, it's a full exercise. It's a full taking, sensing the whole act through presence in each.
Precisely. But the author, E.J. Gold, is telling us, yeah, that's cool. I mean, yeah, we know you're going to be thinking and sensing and paying attention and all that good stuff. Okay, I'm going to take it to another level now, he says. I'm going to up one on you. So you're really paying attention to how your jaw is working as you're chewing your carrot. And you just say, you can taste the carrot with your tongue, and you can see how it's blending with your saliva from the back of your mouth, and you continue to chew it, and then you swallow it as it goes down, and there's the peristaltic movement of the esophagus as the food goes down, and you might even be able to feel it heading toward your stomach. You're really paying attention, right? And your machine's all alive because it's awake. And then EJ says, take it to another level. What does the carrot feel like? And that's important because it's a great exercise in terms of this idea that he puts us in context with at the very first part of the chapter. He says, we're in the context now of the man on the cross, okay? This is a man on the cross, prayer absolute, exercise. There you go. Right?
I got a comment here from Piangio and Jim, too. If you don't mind,
right.
It's a... let me grab it.
Go ahead, Simon.
Jim says, maybe attempting a sense of oneness with the object that is going to become us in form.
Go ahead. It's going to become us. Remember what he said there. Go ahead.
It's a Piangio says, what it feels like to be crunched by the molars of the absolute? That question by Piangio. And Jim responds, maybe that is how the absolute view us, as food as well.
Well, maybe we're kind of food, but we're also we're portals for the eyes of the absolute too. We're portals so that the absolute can look upon and this part of its existence, since we're so far from where its origination is. But part of what Jim is saying, he's introducing the rest of the chapter, and he's saying, okay, I'm going to eat this carrot. I grew it in my garden after all these months, but it's not as simple like, oh, I had a carrot. You are now becoming one with that carrot. That carrot has sacrificed, could be a potato, I guess, has sacrificed it for hopefully higher work, right? It's giving sustenance so that our work can go on in the manner in which we're able to do it.
Mark says, Mark Roach says, reminds me of a second line of the prayer, humbly with heart alive, my presence awakens to thee.
We can see that Mark has, that particular line has lit up for Mark, which means he lights it up as well. He has found it is a transport device for him. Okay? Beautiful. So, a great deal of effort goes into making food. And we are not separate from that activity. And let's say we can't be the conscious, spiritual, holy farmer, and others do that particular job, but then we can respect the work that they're doing and that they've done.
I think Pietro has a question here.
1 second, Simon. Lost Horizon is telling us something here.
Horizon is saying there's a unity of the process of the food, you know, material food coming to the body and being chewed up and swallowed and digested.
And we tend to think of it as separation.
Right.
That the food and me, but as Jim H. is saying, and you're implying a little bit, is there is a unity in that.
There's a unity. And what's the comment?
Go ahead and read. Pianjos, please.
Yeah, if I understand well, I think, I hope I have honored your question, Pianjo. Suffering and being consumed have something in common?
He's posing a question. Do suffering and being have something in common? Is that the question?
And being consumed. And being consumed by, I imagine, by the Absolute, I imagine. I don't know.
Well, I hesitate to use the word being consumed at the moment because right now, for a particular reason, I'm using a term that we're surrendering to that part of our existence. We are a historical personality. We are a human biological machine, but we're also an essential self. And if we surrender from one to the other, and as Ivan's experience was, he felt something missing. If we gradually move more toward the essential self and we open up, there is a surrender. As Mark is saying in the second line of the prayer absolute is humbly with heart alive. Think about that. Humbly with heart alive, my presence comes to thee. Right? He's aware of thee. But so there's this sense of humility suddenly plays into it. That maybe is a form of sacrifice. And all the great Christian mystics do talk about being consumed by, but they're consumed by their passion for the Lord. Okay? We should strive to remember those who have no hope of obtaining first being food for themselves and who are forced to go hungry, to starve to death, even if we sit calmly eating food which has come to us so easily. Let's take that one again, okay? We should strive to remember those who have no hope of obtaining first being food for themselves and who are forced to go hungry, to starve to death. Again, even as we sit calmly eating food which has come to us so easily. Am I reading that wrong? Those who have no hope of obtaining first being food, that's a type of food.
Well, that's material food, isn't it? First being food is the food we eat at the table. First, like,
yeah.
It seems to me that it's a direct association of empathy. Like if you empathize with your food, it's like you're expanding that awareness. It seems to me to suggest that man on the cross awareness has an expansion to empathize with the food that I'm eating. Now, you know, if I'm experiencing that expansion or that empathy, well, what else, who and what else am I going to empathize with? There's a whole swathes of humanity that are not able to have food.
Even that.
Yeah, that are suffering for this very lack here, material level. It's just a man in the cross.
somehow that was what Jim says before, that says maybe attempting a sense of oneness with the object that is being consumed, and it is becoming us.
Well, it also, it seems to me it's not very far to go to say that perspective, you know, that joke that EJ always tells about where the Jesus gets Peter to come up, he get really close, and he's whispering his ear, and he says, "I can see your house from here, Peter." It's sort of like
when he's on the cross.
Yeah, when,
that
he's,
was
on,
a
when he's on the being crucified. But I mean, the other way to interpret that joke is saying, you know, that when the man on the cross is on the cross, he can see everybody's house from there. You know, it's a perspective on humanity.
So now we're going to go into an area where he's, you know, the author's not going to talk about specific food, but certain ritual with regard to food.
Which actually is very reminiscent of the Passover Seder again. Yeah, just,
absolutely, and
yeah.
That, of course, is his background.
Well,
so go ahead and
read. AKA the Last Supper.
And the Last Supper. Why don't you read some of that then, Ivan?
Let's see.
Bread may be dipped.
Bread may be dipped in salt and then passed around the table one piece at a time, followed by a cup of wine. And if sufficient salt was used, this could all be followed quickly by a glass of water. Joke there. But that's very like the rituals at the Passover Seder. You actually repeatedly dip herbs and things in salt water because it's to remember the tears of the slaves, you know, that once we were slaves, but now we're free. So you're remembering slavery. During the dessert and coffee or tea, something should be read from a special workbook to provide mental, emotional, and organic reflexive shocks, which add the extra notes to the food octave, sending substances to the next higher dimension. Then we may decide to sing some special songs and dance some special dances. It's an invocational dinner, in other words.
Okay, so
yeah.
when you hear this, what does it make you think about that? What does it make you think when he's talking about this form of eating and this form of eating food, where he goes on and he says something like, sending substances to the next higher dimension? Isn't that interesting? So not only do we sense what the food is feeling like, in a sense, but it's part of our job. If we're in the context, as indicated in the first chapter, part of our job is to take the substance, to allow a portal for the substance, in a sense, to go to another level. Because after a minute, after a while, that substance becomes energy. And if our energy is working in a certain way, it goes to the next higher level, right? So we have made transubstantiation at that point. Is this not true? All the Catholics will know what I mean by that. Form of Catholics.
I have a question here from, can I?
We have Dan saying also this is the idea of reversing the pump so that instead of just driving the energy downwards, or, you know, just putting it into a lower dimension, or what do you call that? Entropy. Just going with entropy and mechanical nature, you're pushing it upwards, up to a higher dimension.
Well, yeah. And so, once again, that sounds really good. That makes me feel really kind of happy to hear that. But how do you do that?
What's the comment here?
Yeah. Now, I want to finish this point. How do you do that? The way you do it is putting in the kind of essential effort that's talked about in those paragraphs. So there's the But the author is saying to us, there's a possibility you can do this. But it costs a fair amount of energy, effort to do it, and focus and concentration. Then it happens. And no effort of this sort is lost ever. Okay? Go ahead, Simon.
You know, Hawk Lady had a question here. She says, how present can one be when enduring pain?
That's a very difficult question. And this goes back into a lot of the work we did in practical work on self. It's to the extent that you are identified with the that you're identified with the process, that you're identified with the element of pain, then it is virtually impossible to be in present in that pain.
That's interesting. Yeah.
If you smash your finger with a hammer, there's some objective physical pain there, right? If then you can just observe the pain, like I was with somebody and had a habit of like smashing her finger in this particular drawer. It was like she'd go to close the door and she'd so you can have the feeling at that moment, why is this happening to me? You know, why did I hit my finger? Why did my finger get hit with a hammer? You know, it's, why does this always happen to me? Suddenly you're just involved in the drama of the thing. Or the accident that occurred, you just observe it from afar and you notice the body unfolding in its own way. I've known individuals who are very good at being able to do that. It occurs and you just observe it and go on. So, Hawk Lady, the idea is, what is the nature of the pain and what is the extent of your identification to it? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, there are practices related to that process, because you know what comes to mind is the childbirth exercises. You know, EJ did extensive work at a certain period, in the history of this institute, with natural childbirth at home. You know, and there's a whole series of exercises and practices. There's pain that a mother is going to feel in childbirth, which is not avoidable. It's actually nature, or let's say it's part of life. And the EJ went extensively into how to prepare for that, so that instead of falling subject to being carried away by those sensations, that there was a way to collaborate with the sensations to work with that experience. I know, you know, it's not something I could experience or David can speak to here, but you know, I know from women that I've spoken to about childbirth that it can be a very, very powerful awakening experience. That it is actually.
It is.
That's why the natural childbirth is so important.
So the confession is, what is your identification to the pain? That becomes the question back. And if you can observe your identification to it, then something begins to happen. I was in a meeting, a business meeting, and during the meeting, one of the individuals got quite angry. And there's, you know, anger, loud voices going back and forth and this sort of thing. And for a while I got caught up in it and started reacting also to this particular event. Then I was just watching it. After the meeting, I was talking to the individual, and the individual said, yeah, that person really had a lot of energy on that, didn't they? There was no judgment. They had energy on that, didn't they? So what is the nature of the pain? But the only reason to even get into that is because then it might help to start to understand the idea, what is your identification with the pain?
And I guess too, exactly in those lines, there is the degree of that pain, because if it is extremely acute or extreme pain, I think it will kick you out of your center.
For some people, it will kick you out. There's no question, Simon. There was a story I was reading about one of the great Indian gurus, and I don't remember the name now. It was not one of the big names, but it was a realized saint. And he was on his deathbed, dying, and he was covered, and he was carrying on certain conversations, and then he was starting to lose his energy. So somebody turned back the bedclothes and realized that he had extensive bleeding going on. In other words, his body was doing things that he wasn't identified with it. There was a truth for that individual, for that moment, there was truth in that he was not the body. We don't believe that. We read it, we hear it, oh yeah, that's right. So something happens to us, like someone steps on my foot. Why'd you step on my foot? Didn't you see me there, you clown? Then you're identified with it. So, make sense, Simon?
Yes, certainly, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, totally.
Okay, so part of the concept, we're getting into this whole area of food. Food is, we're so identified with food, enormously identified with it. Some of us are. Some of us are identified with food, and some of us are identified with not food. But there's identifications on both sides of it. And we'll get into that later when we start talking about Dante again. That'll be another.
Dante the chef?
But, so, what's being introduced to us, if we get into the context of the very first paragraph again, which I'm just going to have to read it again, okay, Evan?
Yeah.
If we go back to the very first paragraph, it says, here is the method of bringing the machine to life in connection with pure absolute. And then he says, called the evocation of sacred mood and atmosphere. And it begins with a deep contemplation on subjective sensing and feeling experienced by man on the cross. Which is to say, seeing through the eyes, feeling through the heart, sensing through the body. So if we come to that with our next meal, you know, maybe you go to the drive-thru over there at McDonald's and get yourself a gut balm. You might not have the same ritual that we're talking about. But let's say your neighbor is a gardener and has grown some food and has presented that to you as a gift. And you bring that to your kitchen and you start working in that space as if it was a space evocative of a sacred mood. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. There's also, David, this as far as we got here, this very strong indication that it's then, you know, the continuation of the contemplation of the preparation, the food, the chewing of it, and the empathy with, you know, what it would feel like to be the food and all that, then it's like he's got the recognition here that now you've converted that food into energy that could be used for a higher purpose. So what are you going to use it for?
Right.
This is the thing. Are you just going to go, you know, are you going to go and get work out for 20 minutes, or are you going to then, you know, run around the block? Or you, and it, what he's saying is you can, in a group setting at least, we may decide to sing some special songs and dance some special dances. So to me, this is a way of saying, now this is going to direct the energy. You know, we're going to join together and maintain a sacred mood or a sacred space
so
with that energy.
It's not a big stretch to realize that the work we do in an evening like this is associated with bringing a particular kind of food to us, right? Don't we make a meal here of a particular type? Don't we make a meal and we're all part of that meal? We enjoy it. And if we do that, then we're eating a meal together. What then do you do with that meal? What do you do? Where do you take this particular banquet? How do you then use it? For instance, after the class, I often go bowling.
Absolutely. Perfect. Sacred bowling.
So, anyway, how are we doing over there, Simon?
We are fine, David. We are fine.
Okay. So, we'll take another shot at this, okay? We're getting the next... several paragraphs are going to be maybe difficult for some people. Certain ordinary food substances are better teeth than others for the formation of the astral body. Substances such as eyes, brains, bone marrow of certain animals, steamed vegetables, well-baked whole wheat breads, providing you are not allergic to wheat, and many people are, and a small, let us say, 2 or 3 ounce portion of meat, preferably lamb or veal, if it has not been injected with hormones, and if it is prepared as kosher, are best. Why does he say as kosher there, Ivan? What does he...
Well, that has to, again, that has to do with this whole issue of the slaughterhouses and,
yes,
and the imprinting, you know, like emotional, you know, if you're empathetic with your food, you know, this whole issue that vegetarians and vegans have about the meat industry and so on is relevant.
So if you're a kosher butcher, do you happen to know what they do?
Well, it requires, the koshering is a certain way of slaughtering the animal, which is supposed to be humane.
Correct.
But it also involves certain ritual requirements, which is draining all the blood, I know is one of them. And it, you know, there's certain requirements,
but the
and also the blessing. Also, there has to be a blessing of a rabbi, which is to say it's a identified as a sacred process. It's meant to be a sacred space or a sacred, you know, process of butchering.
So what's happened there is that in the more traditional Jewish tradition, they have brought this concept that we're reading here to life. They said, if you are a butcher, if that's your job, which is looked down upon, by the way, by certain members of the Jewish community, but, you know, you're just a butcher.
Mm-hmm.
But the butcher, nevertheless, is the one that brings the sacred space to the process of dressing the meat, as they say, or killing the animal.
Yeah, and again, I suppose in modern times there may be cheating going on, but let's say technically, I mean, the way that should be working is that if you're getting kosher meat from a kosher butcher, it's not coming through some big corporate, you know, huge scale farms and you know, mass like slaughterhouses and all that. So
I think it's very, very
You know, Lost Horizon is talking about a kosher winery requires, you know, great cleanliness, certain processes that are very strict, and supervision by a rabbi, and so on. So anyway, it's there's a lot that wouldn't be going on in the food industry if the food had to be sacred.
That's right.
You know, if everybody were looking out for sacred the food was.
So we're looking, where does our food come from also?
Yeah.
Who's preparing that food?
Yeah.
I happen to be vegetarian at the moment. I'm about 2.5 years into it. And I realized, and part of it was because, well, I happen to know, I start to see how most meat is prepared, and I just couldn't go down that road. But I saw this film where this, it was an American Indian. He's out hunting, and he's with his bow, not with a high-powered weapon, with his bow he kills a deer. And he rushes up to the deer, and he makes sure it's dead, and then he thanks the deer for providing sustenance for his family.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the same methodology.
It's traditional life. It's the way way life was, you know, before a certain time in the development of Western civilization, so-called highly touted Western civilization. I learned this from the Yaqui people in Arizona, in Tucson, in Phoenix, Arizona. They have a whole sacred ritual that goes on about hunting the deer. They invoke the spirit and thank the deer before they go out hunting. You know, and I'm sure that's not at all unusual. I just happen to have come in contact with that, and that's
right.
In a society where they're no longer doing much hunting, they're still carrying on those rituals. They have enshrined that idea, you know.
That ritual, yeah.
Well, for them it's that there's a really remarkable kind of a very non-intellectual, you know, a very body level connection with the spirit world, you know, with the world of animal spirits. Another dimension for them. Actually, they call it the flower world.
Right.
You know,
and once again, I'm going to remind us of context. The very first sentence, he says, certain ordinary food substances are better to eat than others for the formation of the astral body.
Mm-hmm.
So we're entering into an area where what we consume, what we drink, how it's made, where it comes from, and how we consume it starts to become as important as what, you know, even as what it is. So the methodology
right.
becomes part of it.
So, and it might be worth answering. I just remember, in regard to what used to be called the Institute Diet, you know, there was EJ used to have a very strict, used to dictate actually a very strict work diet, which has changed somewhat over the years. You know, his diet has changed, and the kind of recommended diet has changed. But the question that always used to come up is, you know, is it for health reasons? You know, like we don't want to eat meat that's been injected with hormones. And we don't want to eat, bananas and certain vegetables are, infused with sulfur or, you know, some kind of gas to kill insects and so on coming from, you know, Costa Rica or Guatemala or wherever, or Mexico, wherever they're grown and so on. So that has to do with health. But what about these other, you know, there were caveats like not to eat cooked tomatoes, you know, tomato sauce and... fried foods and other things that are not necessarily healthy, but the idea was that there's, besides outright health issues, there are alchemical principles involved as to what are good and foods to eat and not good foods to eat, and also the method of preparation. So they're both principles operating. What's healthy for your body, but also what's beneficial for this higher body formation.
Okay, so the concept is the higher body formation, and you know, and as we go on through this chapter in the next few paragraphs, we're going to see specific foods that are discussed, which goes partly into what you're saying, Ivan, but, you know, like, have you ever asked yourself, why don't we have onions and garlic?
Yeah.
Actually, not just in this tradition, but...
Mm-hmm.
So, we'll continue our culinary adventure next week as we get more into the depths of what's on our plate and how we eat that meal together. So, that's it for this evening, though. I want to thank everybody for coming. And Simon, I want to thank you for a fine job once again on the phone. And look forward to working with you more in that regard.
I'm glad to be able to do it. I'm very glad I really enjoy helping out.
Good night, everyone.
I just want to leave this note with the last comment from Piangio.
Yes,
Any space can be improved and even sanctified by our intent. Amen.
Amen.
By our intention.
Thank you, Piangio, and thank everybody for coming this evening. Good night.
Good night, guys. Good night. Great.